Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I think we'll go ahead and get started. I think they had a breakfast in this room before we were here, so then they decided to just leave the tables in here. So I hope you're comfortable with that. Maybe if we could maybe close that door. Do we usually do that, or do we leave it open?
You can do whatever you want.
Hey, thank you. Some are coming in late. Okay, sorry about that. Maybe we'll leave it open for a little while. I want everyone to feel welcome for sure. Well, thank you so much for joining us. My dear sister and colleague and co-presenter, Mama Yvette, and I are really happy to have you here with us this morning. Thank you for caring enough about what we're talking about today to take the time to come to this workshop. That's really meaningful to us. So we're from Boise, Idaho, and Mama Yvette and I, we do quite a bit of different types of work there together. Some of it is paid and some of it is not paid. But one of the things that we do together, we work at a place called the Center for Global Health and Healing. So it's a health program. It's made up of two clinics that serve specifically patients who have come through refugee resettlement. And we have programs there that are called health advisor programs. It's sort of like community health workers or peer health navigators that are people who've come through refugee resettlement themselves, proficient in English and proficient in our social services programs and our medical programs, and they mentor or guide people, newcomers, from within their own language and culture groups. And right now we have 21 of those, and so I coordinate that program and have the immense privilege of working on a daily basis in a completely multicultural, multilingual, multi-religious environment with that group of people. So much of what we share today, the curriculum that we've developed, comes from those people. So while there are two of us here presenting today, it represents many people, and I always want to acknowledge that. I'm carrying that tenderly in my heart today, that what we've learned together from these folks. So again, thank you for being with us. I'd like to start out by just reading the description of this workshop together, just to kind of get our minds all in the same place as we start out together. We've been given a sacred opportunity to welcome folks from all corners of the globe. Many of us have a deep desire to extend help and hope to our neighbors who have come to the U.S. in search of safety and peace. In this workshop, we will explore together what God wants to do in us and through us as we seek to express love, as we seek to live justly, love mercy, and walk humbly in our communities. So we're going to kind of take a look at that today. Some of what we talk about today regarding folks who are coming through the refugee resettlement program will be information about that experience. Some of it will be. And I know that you're hungry for that. There's a lot of information to be learned. Most of what we're going to spend this hour on, however, today, is about the heart work that God wants to do in us. A lot of times we focus, when we talk about doing ministry or outreach to folks who are resettling, a lot of times we tend to focus on what do we need to kind of fix or change in them, right? How do we help them to become who we want them to be so that they can integrate better with us? That tends to be kind of our focus. But what I really want to spend our precious short time together on today is, how does God want to change the church so that we are ready to provide the welcome and the belonging and the inclusion that reflect the heart of Christ? So that's really what we're looking for. Our purposes today, what we hope to accomplish in this time together, one of those is just to encourage you and hopefully to help you to gain a clearer understanding of what the issues are. Primarily, our number one purpose and goal that we'd like to accomplish, though, is to kind of get a little glimpse into what needs to happen in our hearts in order that we can truly reflect the heart of Christ. Because that's, for Christ followers, that's always the issue, right? There are a lot of facts and figures and information that we can talk about. But for us as Christ followers, the question with a capital T and a capital Q is always, does this reflect the heart of God? Does this reflect what Jesus did on the cross in our communities? I don't hear that being talked about a lot, and that's what we want to talk about today. A lot of times, folks, when they're first learning about refugee resettlement and people who come through refugee resettlement, we look to sources like government refugee resettlement agencies, other organizations like that, as our mentors and guides. And for sure, those organizations are doing really important work. And as the church, we need to be part of that. We need to be participating in that. And we have a higher guide and mentor than that. We have a higher goal than helping people to become self-sufficient financially. So we need to look deeper than that. And where I really see the gap is for people who are coming here through refugee resettlement, where I really see the gap of need, that as Christ followers, we need to be reflecting the heart of God into that gap, is long-term, dignity-giving, mutual relationships. Long-term, dignity-giving, mutual relationships. So we're not going to talk a lot about how to do projects. We're going to talk about relationships. Because if you think about being a newcomer anywhere, you don't want to be anybody's project. You want to become part of us. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. One thing I want you to know is that we are okay with whatever you think or feel as we're talking about these things today. Sometimes when you learn a new way to look at something, it can be really challenging, right? Because not only is it challenging to you as you look at the future, but can also be challenging to you as you look at the past. At least for me, I know I found this to be true. Sometimes I learn something new, especially about relating with folks who are trauma and torture survivors from diverse cultural and linguistic backgrounds. And when I learn that thing, I feel humiliated. Because I look back and I go, oops, that's not what I've been doing. So it takes a lot of courage. We're going to push through that today. As we learn things that are challenging to us, both in terms of the future and the past, we're going to face that together with courage. But please know that any feelings of resistance or guilt or any kind of struggle like that is perfectly normal when we're talking about these kind of things. Because this is kind of a new realm for us, right? This is a new thing for us. What a fabulous opportunity we have as the body of Christ to learn what it really is to reflect the heart of God as a diverse, multicultural, multi-experience group of people. So that's what we're hoping for you today. I hope you don't mind. I'm not really good with these things. But I also, holding the mic is a little restrictive for me, so if I forget and you can just remind me, get the mic back in front of your face. When we talk about reflecting the heart of God, how do we know what the heart of God is? We look at Jesus, right? We want to reflect the heart of God in an increasingly diverse community that's receiving people who are coming through refugee resettlement. How do we do that? What is the heart of God for all people? We look at Jesus. We look at what he taught about loving. And we look at how he himself lived and the people that he chose to engage with. And we look at, most of all, the cross. And when we go to the foot of the cross, we're reminded that the ground there is level. In Christ, there's no slave or free, no Jew or Greek, no male or female, no citizen or refugee status, no documented or undocumented. At the foot of the cross, the ground is level. So I really believe for us as Christ followers, the best thing we can do as we begin this learning journey is to stay right there always at the foot of the cross. That's what we're looking to reflect. So that's the goal of how we think about how do we engage with people who are coming through refugee resettlement. we go, okay, how do we reflect that level ground? That's merciful to all of us, that none of us deserve. So we have to let go of all of that deserving and owning if we're going to truly reflect the heart of God. We can't be territorial because we don't own anything on this earth and we don't deserve anything. So we have to get ourselves into that place, and that's what we're looking to reflect. And that's what we're going to talk a little bit about today and also in our following workshop, which will be part two this afternoon. What does that mean? How do we make those shifts? How do we reimagine our personal lives, our friendships, our church life? How do we reimagine that so that it reflects that beauty of the cross, the level ground at the cross, the healing that's offered at the cross? By his wounds, we are healed. So how do we do relationships that make every encounter a healing encounter? How do we be that channel that reflects who God is, who Jesus is to the world? That's what I really want to focus on today. And I realize that in our minds right now, of course, the words refugee crisis, refugee resettlement, refugee camp, all of those things have been splashed all over everything for quite a while now and bring up a lot of questions and a lot of concerns and sometimes a lot of fears for us. And those are valid concerns, and we'll address a few of them. When you leave today, though, I have a fairly substantial resource I'd like to send you with that has a little bit of written material, some things that I've written that will help you, and also an extensive resource list where you can really extensively figure out why are people coming here, what is the process, how are they vetted, how secure is it, all of those kind of questions. You'll have an extensive resource list where you can spend a lot of time looking at those things because it would take us a whole day, honestly. And those are important questions, and we all need to be learning those things, doing the research, taking responsibility to learn them. And in our precious short time that we have together today, I want to really focus more on our own hearts and what God's wanting to do through us and change in us and shift in us. So that when we are encountering people at whatever level it is, we're doing that in a way that brings healing and that reflects that level ground. That always welcoming, always inclusive, completely unconditional love that we're shown at the cross. So that's going to be our main purpose today. One of the things that I notice about us in the church is that sometimes we preach about and talk about loving our neighbor, but really what people are seeing reflected in us is contradictory to that. That's not really the picture that people are always getting. And as this brother here and I were talking about before we started this morning, sometimes actually, as Christ followers, we're lagging behind a little bit rather than leading in our communities in providing this unconditional welcome. A lot of times people will say to me, well, I don't really want to talk about all of this heart stuff. I want some action steps, right? Because U.S. culture, I don't know if you've noticed this, but it's very much an action culture. It's a get something done culture. Tell me what to do. Give me a list. Number one, I'm going to go home and start this project. And number two, I'm going to finish that project. And number three, I'm going to pat myself on the back and say, I did a really good project, right? We really want action steps. We don't want to just talk and think about something, and that's good. Let me reassure you that the most important action step when it comes to including people who are resettling in our lives, our churches, and our communities, the most important action step is this first. That is an action step. We're not trading out the action steps. The most important action step you can do is start a learning journey. The resource that I'm going to give you before you leave today is called A Lifelong Journey of Learning. Start a learning journey. Get yourself into a learner's posture and be ready, because it's going to be the most terribly wonderful thing you have ever experienced. That is the most important thing we can do. If I start telling you, okay, if someone comes from this country, shake their hand. If someone comes from this country, don't give eye contact. That might feel more practical, the kind of tips and techniques type of thing, but it's like building a house without a foundation. It's like building a house without a foundation. So what I want to spend our time on today is this, the foundation of what is God wanting to shift in my heart? How can I live justice? How can I love mercy? How can I walk humbly? So we're going to switch the order of live justly, love mercy, and walk humbly. We're going to start with walk humbly because that is the foundation. That's the number one thing. We've got to get ourselves out of the expert position and out of the rescuer position and out of the hero position and get ourselves into a learning posture. We are the learners. Folks who are coming through refugee resettlement are our teachers. We are learning from them how to build community together. So getting ourselves into a learner's position and be prepared to stay there. A lot of times when people talk about, for example, learning how to engage cross-culturally, they use the term cultural competence. Have you ever heard that term? Cultural competence. As in professional circles, like, for example, medical settings, they use that term a lot. I don't believe in that term, actually, because I don't think there's such a thing as being competent in anyone else's culture. Most of the time, I don't feel competent even in my own. And if you think about it, each person is such an individual, right? So we can have some general understanding that people who come from this particular part of the world, here are some cultural things that are true about this group of people, right? But then you look within that. For example, think about your own cultural identity, which, by the way, you all have. You have a culture, and you have an ethnicity. You have a cultural background. You have cultural norms. Sometimes, if you don't mind, if I just kind of could be really, really honest with you for a minute, now that the door's shut. Sometimes people who are born in America of European descent think that we're clear. We think that we don't have a culture or an ethnicity. We think we're just the norm. Everyone else has an ethnicity. Everyone else has a culture. Think about the term ethnic food. What do we mean when we say, I really like ethnic food? What do we mean? People, different, exactly. Food that's not my food, right? Now think about that for just a minute. All food is ethnic food, yes? Yeah, and nobody means any harm when we think of it that way, but it's good to challenge that in ourselves. It's really good to challenge that in ourselves. You have an ethnicity, you have a culture, you have a way of being that you've learned, you have a lens through which you view the world, everyone does. When we look at that, think about your own cultural lens that you've been given. Oh, and then think about within that, each family has its own culture, right? All family cultures are not the same. And then think about within a family, usually there are a few people within the family that look at each other and go, we're related? Even sometimes siblings. So each person is truly an individual. And what we want to learn is how we can reimagine our lives, our communities, our homes, our neighborhoods, our churches, so that they are inclusive. So that our circle is big enough that anybody who walked into our circle would know, I belong here. I'm not a stranger here. And now the ground is shaking. Is anyone feeling that? It feels a little too rhythmic to be an earthquake, so I'm not going to worry. So there's no such thing as an expert. A lot of times I'll hear somebody who will say, I really love other cultures. I know a lot about other cultures. As soon as I hear that, I see red flags. So please notice that about yourself. If you start to feel like you are an expert, you're probably not in a really good place. You're probably in trouble. If you start to see, even in one culture other than your own. When we talk about people who are resettling here, for example, in Boise, we have over 105 languages and dialects in our school district now, because primarily because of refugee resettlement. Isn't that a wonderful gift? What a rich, wonderful gift in our communities. What an incredible thing. What a blessing that's come out of tragedy. Yeah. So, impossible to be an expert, and that's not our goal. That we're talking downward mobility here. Our goal is to become more and more of a learner. It's kind of like learning about the Bible. The more you learn, the more you know you don't know. That's the kind of posture we want to take, right? When we're talking about learning about people. And here's why. I'm going to have Mama Yvette come up and talk with you in just a moment. So there's a reality that's kind of hard for us sometimes to accept. This can be a really difficult thing to hear and to think about. So this is something we have to hold and be aware of and accept if we really truly are wanting to learn how to reflect the heart of God to folks from diverse cultural backgrounds, especially who are trauma and torture survivors, which, by the way, by definition, all people who come as refugees are. Our good intentions, I'm going to let you just hear this and let you sit with it for a minute. Our good intentions don't necessarily equal good impact. Good intentions don't necessarily equal good impact. I've noticed for us here in the U.S., we're kind of entitled with our good intentions. It kind of makes us mad that our good intentions don't equal good impact. We kind of feel like, well, if I mean well, everybody should just take it the way I mean it, and it should be fine. Right? We feel a little entitled about that, and that's understandable. Let's just acknowledge that. We wish our good intentions equaled. I wish it. Oh, dear goodness, I would have made so many fewer mistakes and hurt people far fewer times if my good intentions equaled good impact. But think about a time in your life when someone said something to you or did something with good intentions that actually just about ripped your heart out. Good intentions don't always equal, we could even say don't often equal, good impact. That's a heavy thing to hold. And important. Because until we hold that, we're going to stay where we're at. And accept that my good intentions are enough. But because good intentions don't always equal good impact, we have got to go on this learning journey, guys, so that we can work with God in turning our good intentions into good impact. What does that take? If you were going on the mission field, as in get on an airplane and move somewhere, how many months, sometimes years, do you spend preparing to do that? Preparing to relate in ways that are culturally appropriate, understanding the history of the people you're going to be working with, learning the language. Even when we go on a short-term mission trip, for example, we might be taking a group of high schoolers to Mexico for a week. We prepare them for a year. I know I've done that as a youth leader. We spend a year preparing them. And maybe they're not even going to have that much contact with people who live there. But we want to prepare hearts and minds, right? But then we look at people who are coming to our country, and we feel we don't need to do that. Because why? It's our country, and they need to just learn how to do things the way we do them. Now let's go back to that cross where the ground is equal. The ground is level. There is a Savior in the world, and it is not America. So if we go back to that level ground, how do we reflect that in a world that's changing and, thank goodness, getting more diverse? Our good intentions don't always equal good impact. So then we go, okay, God, this many people are around me. How do I prepare for that? It's not going to happen in one workshop. This is the beginning. Start a journey. We sometimes do workshops we call healing encounters in various settings. A colleague and I have developed some curriculum for the Program of Survivors of Torture, which is a U.S. State Department Office of Refugee Resettlement Program. And we provide workshops in all kinds of settings, medical settings, educational settings, refugee resettlement workers. And often those workshops are a whole day or two whole days long. So what we're talking about today is just opening that window just a little bit. And what I'm hoping is that you'll jump through that window and go, okay, this is the beginning of my learning journey, because these folks that are coming to us are so dear to the heart of God. God is near to the brokenhearted. And we need to be near to the brokenhearted in ways that build long-term, dignity-giving, mutual relationships that reflect the heart of Christ. In case you aren't aware, I want to let you know that there's a legal definition of the word refugee. In order to be legally considered a refugee and be eligible to apply for refugee resettlement, when resettlement means when someone is given permission to move to another country that's going to be their permanent home, in order to qualify for legal refugee status, a person has to have been persecuted based on, there are five things: race, religion, ethnicity, social group, or political affiliation, and have crossed an international border. So you maybe have heard the term IDPs, or internally displaced persons. Internally displaced persons are people who have had to flee their homes due to persecution based on those same things, but they are still within the borders of their own country. A lot of times folks are IDPs for a while and then eventually hoping that they can stay within their home country and eventually have to cross a border. When someone crosses an international border, that's when they legally can be defined as a refugee. People who are asylum seekers, you've heard that term, are people who go ahead and travel to a country based on their own means. And when they get there, they apply for asylum in that country. People who come with refugee status have already applied and have permission to come to that country with that status before they come. So asylum seekers and refugees are similar. One gets the permission to resettle before they come. Another comes. Maybe they don't have time to apply for that permission in order to save their lives or the safety of their family. And then they apply permission to stay within the country. And they might get it or they might not. Of the world's refugees, right now there are, by the way, 65.3 million displaced human beings on the face of the earth. One in every 113 people is displaced, forcibly displaced, the largest number ever. Of those, 25 million are considered refugees. Of the world's refugees, less than 1% will be resettled in a given year. Less than 1%. So if there were 100 of us in this room and we were all refugees hoping to have a home, hoping to be given permission to resettle somewhere like the U.S. or another resettlement country, less than one of us would get to. The average time that a person stays between when they are forcibly displaced for that tiny less than 1% that get to resettle, the average time between when they are displaced and when they get to resettle is 17 years. So we have many people who come to the U.S. as refugees who have spent their entire lives in refugee camps, adults. I had a dear friend in Boise when I first moved there, the first friend I made, who was 35 years old. Her parents had fled their home country of Burundi with her when she was 5 days old, and gone to a refugee camp in Tanzania, and she had lived there her entire life until she came to resettle in Boise at age 35. We have people in refugee camps now in various places in the world who are the last person in their family to have been in their homeland was a grandparent. So the blessed few who get to resettle and face a whole new set of challenges and trauma-filled challenges and difficulties in resettlement, those are a very, very small number. So actually, Mama Yvette has agreed today to come and share with you a little bit about, as an example, a little bit about what happened in her life that caused her to become a refugee. And this is a great honor. It's not easy to talk about these things. Many people, many, many years after they've happened, don't choose to talk about them because it's difficult. And she's just going to tell you briefly, but we just want you to know from someone that you already know and love, an example of the kinds of things that people have experienced that have caused them to come to this country through refugee resettlement. So I'm going to ask Mama Yvette to come now. Do you want to hold it or
do you want to? Okay. Santa Mama Lea. Thank you for this opportunity. It's been a blessing for me to be around people who love God. So I will give a little bit of my life. I will try to make it short because it's a long story, but I've been seeing God's hand in my life, and that's why I choose to do this. So for me to come to this country to be a refugee, I was arrested because of my ethnicity. I was in a prison for a year, and when I got arrested, I had a baby who was 2 weeks. I didn't dream about coming to America. I was comfortable where I was born in my country. But for who I am, the way I look, I was forced to leave my country. So when I left my country, when I got forced to leave the country, I went to different country in Benin. You know, Africa, it's continent. So I went to West Africa. For me to follow the process to come to USA, I was with my 3 children. I couldn't come with my husband because he was working with the government. So we stayed there about 5 months. A lot of things happened at that time. We stayed there for 5 months to do interviews, checkups, so many things, so stressful and painful in my heart to see my children being refugees. And I was descendant of a refugee for many years, since 1959, when my parents free were in Rwanda. So we ended up in United States, in Boise, Idaho. It took 2 years for my husband to come. He had to leave the country also to go to a different country to do the same process that I went through, for him to come. So it's not like you wake up in the morning, I want to go to USA, I want to go to Europe. We go through a lot of process and so much to see you leaving your country. So the difficulty that I met when I got here to USA, the first thing, it was language. I speak 5 languages, but I didn't know English. I never got interested to learn English because it's so difficult, and I never know that I will be in the USA. I thought going to France, different parts where I can use my French. But here I came to United States, starting over. And when I came, I was welcomed in the church, a great church. And I still attend that church and my family. I stayed with one family, a wonderful Christian family, but it was really difficult to see my race and this race and look at the history. I was afraid at that moment. I didn't know where I was, but God was with me, and to see how God was working in those families. So, like, the food, it was very difficult, and I didn't know the language to say, oh, I would like to get this, or to feel comfortable to go in the kitchen to cook. I couldn't. It was terrifying and see my kids. I know my children, they want to eat this, but we kind of forced to eat this. And I remember one time we went to the store with that friend and sister. I call her sister. I call her mom. So we went to the store and she said, we need to get her dog. And I know a dog, we don't eat dog. So she could see my face. I was like, oh. And she told me she speaks Spanish. So she was using a dictionary. And some words in Spanish, it's kind of French words. So she's like, no, 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 it's not dog. And she was showing me pictures. And I was like, okay, thank you, Lord. We are not eating a dog. So for the sake of the time, I think I will pass to Mama Leia. There is so much, and I'm grateful for God, what he has done and what he's doing now.
Thank you. Our sister has given you a great honor. I have known Mama Yvette for a long time, and I haven't heard her speak much about her personal story in public settings. So I just want you to know what a sacred gift. You can let your heart be barefoot because you're on holy ground right now to be with Mama Yvette and just to be in her presence and the honor that that is for us. And our country is receiving many, many people giving us this honor to walk on holy ground with people. If I were to ask you, if we could go around the room and I could ask you, when you go into a new setting, what is it that helps you to feel a part of that new place? Maybe a new school, a new town when you've moved, a new job, a new church. When you go into some place that's new for you, you're the newcomer. What are the factors that need to be in place that help you to feel welcome and that you belong and that you can contribute to that group? I'll let you think about that. And if you have any thoughts, I'd love to hear them. What are the factors that help you? Yes.
A smile.
Thank you. Smiling, a welcoming presence. Yes. Huge, right? Yeah. What was that? Some kind of advocate, someone to be beside you so you feel like you're not alone. Awesome. What else? Yes. When you start to kind of feel like you know the place. Like, for example, here at this conference, I'm going to leave and not have that feeling. Yeah, that's a good one. What else? What helps you to feel like you can contribute, you can be a part of something? Yes.
The welcoming thing, when someone comes back and continues to welcome you.
Okay.
And the other is when someone asks me for help.
Yes, good. So it's not a one-time quick welcome, and then leave you. It's ongoing and asking you for something that you have to offer. Thank you. What else?
When someone remembers
your name. What if your name is really difficult for that person to pronounce? It means a lot more. Thank you. Thank you. Yes.
Someone willing to accept your attempt to speak.
Yes. Yes, thank you so much. How many of you have learned, significantly learned, not just greetings, but significantly learned a language other than your original language? You know that stage you go through where you sound like a 3-year-old? Yeah, it's really important, isn't it, to have someone that gives that dignity. Yeah, it's beautiful. Thank you. Anything else? What helps you to feel that you belong? Okay, so if you're talking about cross-lingual, you need things you can read in your own language. Thank you, that's important. Okay, now think about a time in your life where you went somewhere that you didn't feel very welcome or that it was difficult to integrate into. A new school, a new job, a new home, a new whatever, a new church. What are the factors that make it difficult to really belong somewhere?
People expect me to know what I'm supposed to do.
Okay, people's expectations, not giving you that time to be a learner. That's awesome. Well said. The absence of the things we've already talked about. Do you did you play when you were a kid? Did you play that game Red Rover? Red Rover, Red Rover, send Jessica right over, right? There are kind of various, I've learned, various versions of a game like that or similar to it in many parts of the world. Red Rover, I was not a kid that liked Red Rover. I think on some playgrounds they've actually stopped allowing children to play Red Rover because it can be kind of painful. But here's what I like about it. I like thinking about the game Red Rover. Remember, you have people on this team who are us. And then you look across, and then there's this line of people over here, and that's them, remember? And you're looking over there, and you think of somebody that you want to bring over, right? And so you go, Red Rover, send Jessica right over. And if she and she comes running over. And what happens if your hands hold, and she doesn't break through, what happens to her? She becomes part of us. 2 seconds ago, we were looking over there. There's the other team over there. And she was them. And now, suddenly, we make room for her and we pat her on the back. She's part of our team now. She's part of us, right? Us suddenly, or them suddenly became us. So here's the thing with us grown-ups. We have forgotten that as soon as somebody comes on over, they're part of us. We are often, whether consciously or unconsciously, more comfortable keeping them, them. Keeping them the other. And that does not reflect the level ground that's at the foot of the cross. Our goal as Christ followers, in order to reflect that, has to be becoming us. Becoming us. It's not so much how are we going to help them. It's how can we all become us. How can we reimagine the way that we do things so that we can all become us? And that is loving mercy. Because mercy, it's not about just about giving mercy, it's about giving and receiving mercy. Because remember at the cross, we're all as much in need of mercy as the other person. Becoming us is about that, is about all of us being in that place where we need mercy. We give and receive mercy from each other. What that means for members of the host culture here is that we have to get ourselves out of that rescuer position. Now, the word rescue isn't a bad word in itself, right? But a lot of times when we talk about that kind of being rescuers, or sometimes people call it the hero mentality, we do that without even knowing it sometimes. And this is partly cultural. It's partly from being a part of a nation that is very powerful in the world. But we tend to sometimes, if we don't stop and think about it, we kind of see ourselves as being the people that are going, that are always the helper. We're always the ones that have the knowledge that you need. We're always the teacher. You're always the learner. But in order for us to become us, to become that reflection of the heart of God, we're going to have to get ourselves out of that position and realize we are all teaching each other. Everyone teaches. Everyone learns. One of the things that can be really important for that is that we need to learn to use words and language that are dignity-giving. So I'm going to tell you something that you're probably not going to hear in a lot of places, but through my time, the time that I've spent with so many folks who've come through refugee resettlement from so many places, I am more convinced that this is true than ever. And so I can't not tell it to you because you need to know it. Your heart needs to know it. Being called a refugee is so dignity-stripping for many people. We need to think about the way we use that word. It's not a bad word in itself. It can be especially useful sometimes when talking about definitions and when used as an adjective. For example, refugee resettlement, the refugee journey, a refugee camp. But to refer to human beings as refugees is not dignity giving. Most people who've come to the United States through refugee resettlement know that that word refugee means they've suffered enough that they have had to leave their homes. People do not choose to leave their homes. They have suffered. It holds social stigma. It represents that suffering and trauma. As soon as they get off the plane, people no longer wish to be a refugee. Again, I'm not hearing this talked about a lot, but I think it's really important. Our words are important. What does Jesus say about our words? Where do they come from? The overflow of our heart. Out of the overflow of our heart, our mouth speaks. So our words can inform us a lot about what's going on in our hearts, right? It goes both ways. So I'll just give you this little hint, and again, I've learned this from many friends. It's so dignity-giving to people to not be known as and referred to as a refugee, and I'm going to let Mama Yvette talk a little bit about that, too, here in just a minute. It holds, even back home for people, a lot of stigma. Folks who have grown up, maybe the children of someone who would be called a refugee, a part of their persecution and oppression can be based even on that stigma. So we're looking for ways to refer to people. It can be a label, right? Nobody wants to be labeled. Nobody wants to be identified by a certain experience in their life or a piece of paper that they carry that says, I have refugee status. Nobody wants to be identified that way. Everyone wants to have the opportunity to define themselves. So we're looking for ways that give dignity. Most of the time, when we refer to someone, we can say, my neighbor, my friend, Mama Yvette. I don't need to say my friend, Mama Yvette, who's a refugee. I don't need to say my refugee coworker, right? That actually hurts my heart for that to even come out of my mouth. There's no need. Sometimes we identify people in ways that there's no need. If we're becoming us, whenever you can, just refer to that person as who they are. Recently, I was giving a workshop to a group of property managers who rent property to folks who are resettling. And I was noticing when they talk about tenants who were born here, they call them tenants. When they're talking about tenants who came through refugee resettlement, they call them refugees. So we requested that they call everyone tenants because that's their relationship with those people. So think about your relationship with the person, refer to that. When, for informational purposes, you do need to use that word refugee, think of using it as an adjective, not a noun. Or we can use what we call person-first language, which would be like people who are coming through refugee resettlement. See how I put the word people first? My friend who came here from Congo, right? My coworker who came here through refugee resettlement, right? So we're not labeling the person. We're using person-first language. What a beautiful way to reflect the dignity and the mutuality of Jesus. What a beautiful way to say, I see this person as a human being. I see this person as a much-loved, treasured child of God, as opposed to a person who fits into this category. Right. I'm going to let Mama Yvette share some thoughts about that, because I know she has some experience and some thoughts about this.
Refugee. Some of us, we were born as a refugee because our parents left their country. I think a lot of people have watched movie of Rwanda Hotel. And my parents came from Rwanda because their tribe too went to Congo. So I was born in Congo. But since I was a child, I had names. They called us names. We never be called Congolese. We were always refugee. And that took a time for the new generation to decide to go back to our country, because where we were not belonging there. So it took time, it took years to go back to our country. But as you know, thousands of people died at that time for genocide. So for me, refugee, it's deep, deep word, and then you can, the way it sound. And some of the people, when you call them a refugee, it takes them back in a refugee camp. In everything they went through for them to come here. And you come here, you become a United States citizen, been here for 16, 17 years almost, and to call me a refugee, it's like I'm going back. I'm going to be called a refugee, and my children are going to be called a refugee. So it's so painful to use that word. You have to be careful. Thank you, Mama Leah.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I don't think that needs anything further after hearing from Mama Yvette. So we're kind of winding our time down here, so I want to talk just for a minute about living out justice, living justly. And so I'm just going to give you one little thing to kind of go with. And again, please know that what we've talked about today is the beginning of a learning journey. I hope that you'll take with you the resource. I'm going to, maybe we'll try to go to the door or something with that so that you can make sure. And also, we're going to be doing another workshop at 2 today where we'll kind of continue and with some more practical suggestions. So we would welcome you to come to that also if you'd like to. But the thing I want to leave you with is this. Have you heard the term ethnocentrism? I think probably most of you that would come to a conference like this are familiar with the word ethnocentrism. If you look that up, of course, in the dictionary, it talks about when we view our way of thinking or our group's way of thinking as superior to others' way of thinking, right? Sometimes, though, I think it comes more in the form of when we think our way of thinking is the standard way of thinking. Our way of viewing the world is normal. Sort of like that ethnic food thing, right? My way is the normal way, and then there are all the other ways. But you hear that us and them in there, right? That otherness in there. So if you're taking notes, you can even do this. If not, you can just picture it. I usually like to do this on a whiteboard or something, but picture a circle. And if you make some little dots on the outside of that circle, and you say to yourself, these represent the various cultures in the world, right? The little dots around the circle. There are many cultures in the world. And ethnocentrism puts a little dot right in the center and says, mine is here. You might even say, oh, I love all the other cultures of the world, but mine's in the center. Mine's the standard. This is the normal way of thinking. And then there's all the others. An example of that would be time orientation. Many of you are familiar with time-oriented cultures and our beautiful sermon that we had last night. One of my favorite sermons ever. That dear brother shared with us. He talked a little bit about time orientation, right? As opposed to relationship orientation. Boy, we can get judgmental with each other on that one really fast, right? That would be an example of something where we tend to go, okay, well, this is the right way. Now, these people are coming here. We got to teach them all how to follow the clock. We got to teach them the right way, right? We kind of have that ethnocentrism. I'm in the center, centrism, right? So I'd like to propose to you as we finish up today a way to reimagine that. And I got to give a little disclaimer here. I'm kind of bad about making up words. This is a word you will not find in the dictionary. But I'm still going to suggest that instead of ethnocentrism, we look for ethno-mutuality to reflect that ground at the foot of the cross, ethno-mutuality. So if you're drawing your circle, whereas with ethnocentrism, we said there are many cultures in the world, put the dot in the center, mine is here. Ethno-mutuality would be this. We have a circle, and we say there are many cultures in the world, and mine is one of them. You take yourself out of the center and put yourself here. Mine is one of them. Imagine how different that would make our view of things if we could get ourselves out of the center. Now, this makes a lot of people worried. A lot of times we worry. Does that mean I have to give up my own cultural identity? This is a lot of people's greatest fear about our communities becoming more diverse. If I welcome people of all ethnic backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, religious backgrounds, linguistic backgrounds, trauma histories, If we make our circle big enough for everybody, does that mean I'm going to lose my own identity? Isn't that kind of that fear we have at the base of it? Does that mean we're going to lose our own cultural identity? I truly believe that it is possible for every person to come into the circle and bring 100% of who they are. And look for ways to express that allows everyone else to bring 100% of who they are. So we're adapting the ways that we do things to make room for each other. We could talk hours about that and the practical ways that can play out. But this can be life-changing, to get yourself out of the center of the circle. Can be life-changing for you and relationship-altering for the people that you're relating to. So I want to just let you start that journey of becoming ethno-mutual as it reflects the level ground at the foot of the cross. I think we have a couple of minutes. I don't know if some... I wanted to leave a little bit of time for questions, concerns about the things that we've brought up today. We actually have like 2 minutes. So let me just tell you this, and we'll hang around for a while, by the way. Please don't underestimate the power of a loving, comforting, healing presence in a human being. Jesus coming through you as a loving, comforting presence. Please don't underestimate how healing that can be for people. Yes.
For other people, maybe, to understand that it's not just your neighbor, but it's your neighbor from someplace else.
Yes.
So, can you speak to maybe using the word immigrants or some other?
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. That's a good question. When is it appropriate to use it at all? Again, the first question I always ask myself is it really needed to identify at all? And sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. But first, always ask yourself that question. Is it really important for that person to know that this person came here as a refugee? And a lot of times, if we're honest with ourselves, it isn't, because we're trying to reflect mutuality and inclusion. When there is a time for informational purposes that it's needed, use dignity-giving terms like, my neighbor who came to this country through refugee resettlement. Yes, that takes more time. And yes, it takes more thought. And yes, it is worth it. Because it's a tiny, tiny little way that we can make a little bit of extra effort in order to reflect the love of Jesus. So I would say when you do need to use it to identify for informational purposes, just switch that around instead of just using it as a noun, like the refugee who lives next to me, my neighbor who came to this country through refugee resettlement, or my neighbor who arrived here with refugee status. Refugee status, not quite as good. I prefer through refugee resettlement. But that person first language, put the person word first and then the descriptor afterwards. Yeah. Oh, the word immigrant? Right. Right. Thank you. I would do the same thing with that word. I would do the same thing with that word, because for many people, whatever, you know, or someone who comes as a refugee, that's one way to immigrate here. But for many folks who have come through any form of immigration, same thing. Ground at the foot of the cross, right? So looking to instill dignity in our language, same thing. When you don't need to identify the person as someone who has immigrated here, don't do it. When you do need to, think of a dignity-giving way to say it, because that's love. What a rich opportunity to show love just by saying, my neighbor who moved here from another country, or my coworker who came here from whatever country it is. Whether or not the person has a certain set of papers has nothing to do with how we treat them, how we reflect the heart of Christ to them. So that is completely irrelevant. I don't like the term legal or illegal. I don't think a person is... It's not legal to be illegal to be a person. So I'm not trying to be political. I'm just saying, as we reflect the love of Jesus, people are people. This human being reflects the image of God. So let's talk about them as human beings in whatever way we can. Tremendous way to offer love and kindness. I'm so glad you brought that up, because I hadn't thought about the difference in the words before to talk about that today. So thank you very much. I think it applies the same. Yes. Yes.
What they went through, and I'm asking the question, is it helpful or not helpful?
Thank you.
Do you have a better answer to that, or do you have to just wait and build the relationship and let them volunteer it before?
Thank you.
Ask them about what they went through. Is that something that will bring
yes. That is a golden question. I so appreciate you asking that. And we're going to talk really specifically about that in our second workshop, but also let me just answer your question briefly here. So the question is about when you know that someone has been through trauma, is it helpful or not helpful to bring that up? When we do our 2 o'clock workshop, Mama Yvette's going to help us to talk about that a little bit too. And what a beautiful question and a sensitive question. Thank you. So the important thing for folks who have survived trauma and torture is that the survivor is in control of their information. When trauma happens to you at the hands of other human beings, you are out of control of your environment and what happens to you. That is something that is taken from you. So the loving, healing way to interact with people are ways that restore that control and choice of that information back to that person. So the survivor always needs to be in control of that information. Now, this kind of runs into something cultural, because cultural, for folks who were raised in the U.S., it's friendly and kind to ask someone immediately upon meeting them, tell me your story, right? That would be a way, or tell me about, or what happened to you, or why are you here, right? That would be culturally an appropriate thing to do to show friendliness and kindness for folks. So there's cultural issue with that. For some folks from diverse cultures, that's not even culturally appropriate for them. People don't even ask themselves personal questions like that without a long-term trusting relationship. And for trauma survivors, this is part of what we call trauma-informed care. For trauma survivors, we do not ask questions about the trauma story. We do not ask that. We focus on building relationships based on what we have in common now. Some people, part of their healing journey is talking about their trauma story. Some people will never voice it to anyone. And that's okay. That's not up to us. So the best thing we can do is build relationship, build trust, and then people go, well, what will we talk about? Well, there's a lot about that person to talk about other than their trauma. Talk about whatever you have in common. Our kids go to the same school. You're studying. How's school going for you? What baseball team do you like? Things about the now, right? Build the relationship on who this person is as a human being. A trauma or torture survivor is more than their suffering. That is not what defines them. Same with you, right? You've suffered. Trauma is so pervasive that there are trauma survivors in this room. You are not defined by your suffering. So build it. I so appreciate that question. It is one of the most important. Build the relationship based on the now, what we have in common with each other as human beings. Get to know each other. If you build trust and that person wants to share some of their trauma with you, they might or they might not. And when they do, if someone does start to tell you something about the difficult things they've been through, you receive it, you validate it, you don't ask follow-up questions. That allows the person to always be in control of their own information. Receive it and validate it lovingly. Sometimes someone will tell you one sentence, and that's all they want to say. They might even be testing you to see if you can handle it. Because people are usually afraid that we can't handle the horror of what they've been through. And if they see that it upsets you, if you express that you're horrified or that you're upset or you cry, sometimes they'll go, okay, this person can't handle it, I won't tell anymore. But if you can receive it calmly and lovingly and validate it, then a lot of times later the person might share more with you if they want to. Or they might not. That's where we are there to be that loving presence that reflects the heart of Jesus. Thank you so much for that question. And thank you all for being... I wish we had 6 hours together. Please feel free to come and find us. We'd be happy to talk with you. Thank you so much. Oh. And our